Welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. The John N. Gardner Institute for Excellence in Undergraduate Education strives to advance higher education's larger goal of achieving equity and social justice.
Good day, colleagues, and welcome again to Office Hours with John Gardner. This is your host, John Gardner. Thank you for spending your time with us. Have a treat for you today. I'm going to interview a relatively new colleague of mine. I discovered him a few months ago and got quite intrigued in his work and thought it's definitely innovative and we should talk about it. So I'm going to now introduce you to Professor Dr. Duncan Pritchard, who is professor of philosophy at the University of California at Irvine. And he was recommended to me that I get to know him because he and I share, I think, several common interests. But one of those major interests is what is the role of colleges and universities in any country, for that matter, in introducing students to understanding and reflecting and acting upon value systems. And this comes naturally to Professor Pritchard because he is a philosopher. And one of the things I want to explore to him is how did a philosopher get connected to the kind of work he's going to tell you about. But as you will soon hear, Duncan is a native of Great Britain. He grew up in the Midlands of England. He's married to a partner from Scotland. So you're going to hear that in his voice. So that means he speaks better English than I do. I'll try not to butcher your language, Duncan, okay, and do it justice. But anyway, so I've just told our audience a little bit about you, but I'd like you to kind of kick this off, if I may so informally address you as Duncan, and tell us about your own unique professional life story and how you got to doing some innovative things that not all philosophers get to do.
John, thanks very much for having me on your podcast. I'm delighted to be doing this. My educational journey, I guess one interesting feature of it is first generation student. I think that gives you a bit of perspective on education. You know, it gives you a little bit of an outsider perspective. Certainly it felt that way a bit in Britain anyway. And especially so if you end up doing a subject like philosophy, like I did, because I think a lot of first generation students, insofar as they make it through and they become academics, it's usually more vocational type subjects. So I think that's part of, you know, where I'm coming from in a way. I think I started thinking more about education and what it is in itself and what its purpose was in a way that perhaps some of my colleagues didn't. I mean, it is striking actually in philosophy that the philosophy of education is a kind of a niche topic, which always struck me as strange because, you know, it seems to me that, you know, philosophers, we think about everything and we're also teachers. So surely, you know, we should be thinking about what it is to teach and what the purpose of education is. Anyway, certainly I found myself asking those questions a lot. And initially I was working in Scotland before I came here, I had a chair in Edinburgh. And I just started getting interested in, they call them philosophy in schools. I started a philosophy in schools program and a philosophy in prisons program. It's really critical thinking rather than philosophy. It's to try and help people to think for themselves. And it was really seeing the results of that. It was basically taking sort of theory, stuff I've been working on as a philosopher, as an epistemologist, interested in truth and knowledge and so on, try and put it into action in an educational context and seeing its effect. That's really kind of what converted me to the importance of innovation in education. Once you start thinking about education is and what you're supposed to be doing, I think it actually transforms what you do.
You just said you used an interesting word. It has a number of connotations. You said you got converted.
Because you know
the conversion process.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because I think a lot of people think teaching is, and I understand this. They think it's a sort of an instinct you get, and there's something to that. But when you start thinking about what it is you're doing and what its purpose is, I think that transforms how you do it. I mean, even if it doesn't transform a lot of the practice, I think it transforms how you conceive of that practice. And I think there is a bit of a conversion process in that. It's seeing, I mean, for example, take the prison stuff we did. I mean, this is true also of the schools as well, but especially the prisons, the effect some of these educational initiatives had.
Some would say that schools are like prisons.
Yeah, well, you've got a captive audience, haven't you, in both cases? I mean, yeah. Different than higher education. The higher education, they can walk out.
But they have the guards and the correctional officers, too, and the wardens.
But you see these transform, you know, when you change how you do things, you see this transformative effect. And it's trying to recreate that. I think there's a tendency to think, you know, education is just kind of, but you essentially, it's like the onus is put on the learner. The learner has to make all the work. And if they put the work in, they get in. If they don't, then it doesn't work. And that, you know, it's like there's a limit to what you can do as an educator. But actually, I think you can to realize there's a great deal of what we can do to help people with improve, as we say in the lingo, their educational outcomes.
So you went from developing a context to apply philosophy as a way of thinking to help incarcerated citizens in the United Kingdom. And now you are at one of the most elite, selective research universities in the United States. Which actually I learned UC Irvine does have a bachelor's degree for formerly incarcerated students, I understand.
I'm involved in that, actually. I'm on the board of that. This is a great project, the UC Lifted project. And now we're trying to pair up my project, which is primarily an undergraduate project, with the with this new project, which is involved with the prisoners. The prison project is fantastic. It's a prison down in San Diego right now, but they're hoping to extend it. And it's had, a transformative effect on the lives of these prisoners.
Wow. Well, you're just shattering rather a stereotype that I had about the University of California. And this is fascinating. You said that earlier that you, as a first generation student in Britain, you decided not to do something and you used the word vocational. And yet this sounds to me like it's vocational, Duncan.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly applied anyway. I mean, I think what's interesting about it is that it's the work I'm doing is driven by theory. There's a theory in the background. That's where I got into this, is thinking about knowledge, rationality, and so forth, the intellectual virtues, good ways, good habits of thinking, and how we propagate them, and then trying to apply that to the educational case. So there's a theoretical background there, and I think that informs what I do. But certainly, it is applied. So in that sense, it's vocational. And I think this is different. You know, philosophers, they don't take that extra step. They don't try and apply it. They just stay at the theoretical level. It's other people that apply it, you know, people from other disciplines. But one thing we've been trying to do is to try and see how that works. And, you know, it's actually pretty exciting. I mean, it's exciting on two levels. One, you get to actually see these ideas in action. The other is that kind of work is also, by its nature, interdisciplinary. You get to work people from lots of different disciplines and also people outside of the academy as well. You know, we did the prison education project. There are people involved at they're not academics, but they're teachers involved in prison education. So they're coming at this from a different level. They're not researchers, but they're just at the chalk face, as it were. So you get to engage with a whole range of different people. And that's an exciting feature of these kind of projects.
Well, and you're also developing, the phrase I use for it is a kind of ethos model, a set of core values and beliefs that you're trying to inculcate into Irvine students. And I've got to be careful how I say that, because the political right in the United States believes we are trying to inculcate a set of values at liberal universities into students that they'd rather see us not pursuing, those who hold that view politically. But let me hear your language. What are you trying to inculcate in Irvine students?
So we focus on, it's the intellectual virtues. So we're focusing on a set of admirable traits, character traits, which are traits that are character traits that are geared towards the truth. They're one of the distinctive features of them is that they involve a care and concern for the truth, a valuing of the truth, of accuracy, getting things right, and so forth. And it's these sort of character traits. I mean, we focus on four primarily. We call them the anteater virtues. So Peter the Anteater is the mascot of UC Irvine. So the idea is we pick these four. We think they're kind of core intellectual virtues, and trying to instill in our students the idea that as good UCI students, they should be propagating these four traits. They are curiosity, integrity, we mean the intellectual integrity specifically, intellectual humility, and intellectual tenacity. So curiosity, obviously, that, you know, we think that's core to a higher education experience. You know, we're inquirers, we're scholars. So, you know, inquiry is driven by, we have to have that drive for inquiry, a virtuous drive. So that's the curiosity, the virtue of curiosity. We chose integrity because in university life, there's a lot of negative focus on what you might broadly call academic misconduct, plagiarism, and so on. You know, that's a core part of what we try and teach. And what we want to do is flip that conversation and make it positive. So rather than focus on what you shouldn't do, focus on what is the good trait that a scholar has? You know, not just don't plagiarize, don't engage in academic misconduct, but positively speaking, what is intellectual integrity? You know, what is like respect for the truth? How does it manifest itself here in a scholarly context? And then the other two virtues, humility, intellectual humility and intellectual tenacity, we think they're really important to the higher education, but also important to pair them. So humility is about being aware of one's fallibility, being open to new ideas, listening to others, respectful of others, you know, not being arrogant, not being dogmatic. Intellectual tenacity is about being able to overcome intellectual obstacles, you know, grit, as it's sometimes known, not just simply, you know, giving up at the first sign of intellectual difficulties. And we thought it was important to pair them because I get the sense that a lot of students think that they're opposed. You know, as it were, to have tenacity is to have conviction. To have conviction is not to listen to other people and not to engage other people. You know, that somehow that if one listens to people you disagree with, that shows a lack of conviction. Mm-hmm. Equally, I think a lot of people think intellectual humility is, they have the wrong conception of it. They think it's kind of like, it's like a sort of a downgrading of oneself or something like that. But we're trying to explain how it's more as a virtuous trait. It's more like a respect for others. It's like a recognition of fallibility, and then it's outer directed. It's how one treats others, how one treats debate, how one listens respectfully to other people, and so on.
And did you create these? Did you name these values, or have you been working with a group that's done that, or is this something you inherited?
So the intellectual virtues tradition, I mean, this is a really old tradition. In fact, one of the things we do with the project is try and teach a bit about the history, because, you know, gets into the university context, you know, it's good to teach the theory as well as the application. So, I mean, in ancient Greece, you get these ideas. Aristotle is the foremost exponent, but it was the idea of the virtuous life as being the good life. And for Aristotle, the virtues aren't just moral virtues. We tend to think of virtues morally these days, but for Aristotle, the most important virtues were intellectual virtues or practical virtues. And so these virtues get developed over time and people carve them up in different ways. So those four, you'll find them in different forms in the ancient world, perhaps not quite in those forms, but later on they start to appear more in that form. You also get them in other traditions as well. And this is one thing we talk about, because there's always a danger with this, that people think that it's allied to a particular intellectual tradition. And one of the things we try and point out is that pretty much every world tradition has some conception of virtuous character and its importance. You find it in Confucian thinking, you find it in classical Indian philosophy, for example. So lots of world traditions have the same idea. It seems like it's an idea that's common to human civilization, that there are certain core intellectual traits which are admirable and which we should try and propagate in others. And in particular, educationally, we should propagate. This is also an ancient idea you find in many traditions, that education isn't just about teaching facts and skills. It's also about developing character, in particular, intellectual character. And so that's what we're trying to do with this project. We're trying to get students to have a broader sense of their education. I think a lot of, in higher education, there's a lot of instrumentalism. You know, students just think piecemeal, they're learning this to get a grade, to do this. So they don't see how things connect. They don't see how it connects to a lifelong development of themselves. They don't see how it connects to their flourishing as people. And they don't see how like different parts of the educational experience connect to one another. And one of the beautiful things I think about the intellectual virtues is it gives you a framework to see, to understand your educational experience and how it all fits together and how it helps you develop as a person. And so that's what we're trying to instill with the students. It's a program that takes the student right from orientation through to graduation. So at various points, we're instilling in them, trying to instill these virtues into them, and also the theory behind it. You can do that higher education level, you know, theory and application. So that by the time they get to the end of their degree, they have a framework in which they can make sense of their educational experience. And we are finding this is having a big effect on educational outcomes. So alongside this project, there's a there's a measurement project as well. So we've got social scientists studying the effect this is having on educational outcomes. So that's another exciting feature of the project, to see empirically what effect we're having. So it's not just doing it, but also showing. So we want to make a case for other universities to show that this can be done, proof of concept, and it's effective.
So how are you going about trying to make the case for other universities?
So what we're going to do is we're running this project now for several years. We'll be we've done some shorter studies, empirical studies, and we've published some papers, got great results. But now we're doing a longitudinal study, so over several years, taking one body of students and comparing it with a control class. And then we've got various ways of measuring the educational outcomes. At UCI, it's quite unusual. We have a state-of-the-art database for tracking educational outcomes. It's the best of its kind, run by a colleague of mine who's involved in project, Richard Aram, in education. So we're very lucky we've got this resource there, and we can bring it to bear to do this longitudinal study. And then as we get results, we'll publish them. And at the end of the project, we've already begun this, actually, to publish the results. And we're going to make all the modules and all the materials freely available so that other places can just simply, as it were, take it off the peg, see the results, see that it works, and employ it in the institution. And we're already starting to partner with other institutions to get some institutions at the vanguard, will help them start up. But eventually the idea is all the materials will be there, and we want to create a conversation where, people can see the effectiveness of this and the point of doing it. It's interesting. Projects have this sort of been done in schools, and their success has been measured and studied and so on. But no one's done it at R1 University before. And I think there's a good reason for that. You need an awful lot of buy-in. And we're just incredibly lucky at UCI that we have a chancellor who's really interested in pedagogical innovation. We have a vice provost for teaching and learning who's really interested, Michael Dell, in educational theory and innovation. And so, we've been pushing an open door. But this is, I think, a unique set of circumstances. We have that, like the institutional support. We've got the body of researchers. We've got this unique database for measuring educational outcomes. And so if we can bring this all together and show that it works at R1 University, then that's proof of concept. And so, we can roll these resources out and hopefully get other universities to see that that this is something that's feasible. Because, I'm sure that there is this big debate about how a lot of colleges, to what extent are they actually improving educational outcomes?
Yes, right, yeah.
And I think, one thing we're seeing with these results is, big effects. Even more interestingly, I'm sure when you do pedagogical interventions, usually the positive effects, they tend to be disproportionate in the sense that students who are doing well already gain the most. Mm-hmm. Students who are doing poorly already gain the least. So you get these spikes and troughs, as it were, in terms of the effects you're having. But one thing we're finding with this project is that we're getting very good results, and they're stable across all the main demographic groupings, whether it's first-generation students, low-income students, gender, ethnicity, and so on. So, that's kind of like the holy grail of a pedagogical intervention. So what we want to do is show that, get further evidence for this and then make the case for other universities for thinking about how they might reform their curricula along similar lines.
So you're thinking about reforming, is it reforming the curriculum, meaning what is taught, or is it reforming how people are taught, or both?
It's both. So in terms of how things are taught, so one thing we're doing is we're doing faculty training to try and train people up because we're trying to change the culture in terms of framing the educational experience in terms of educating for intellectual character and what that means. And that's one thing we point out to a lot of faculty is that many of them are probably doing this already. They just don't know exactly. They don't have they haven't, as it were, got the framework to think of it in those terms. But that's, if they're doing a good job, I'm sure many of them are doing a good job. Usually good teaching has that structure anyway. But the idea is that when you make that framework explicit, you improve the educational outcomes. That's one thing we're finding with the study. So we want to change the culture in that get the educators to be explicitly thinking of what they're doing in those terms. And also relatedly, we want the students to be thinking of their education in those terms too. Again, if students conceive of their education in terms of their development of character, this improves educational outcomes. So we need to give them the skills to do that. So it's the educators and the educated working together. And that's the sense in which you change the curriculum.
Are you telling UCI students that, are you explicit about telling them that if they buy into this and try and practice this, this is going to change their character?
Yeah, intellectual character, though. So, yeah. I mean, this is a really important distinction. So, you know, character has a broader meaning, you know, right. Like in terms of, you know, morals and so forth. And we're very careful about that. It's just intellectual character. And I think this is really important at a higher education level. You know, we have to be very careful about, we're not telling people what to think. We're trying to help people to think for themselves. That's the really crucial thing. I mean, you mentioned earlier about values. I mean, really, I think there's only one value in this project, and it's truth. You know, in the sense of, you know, accuracy, getting things right, avoiding error, and so on. We take that to be a sort of a mainstay value of higher education. You know, you can't really make sense of what we're doing as scholars without that value. But the thought is to take that value seriously. And if you do, then you're led into this picture whereby, well, we should cultivate intellectual traits which involve caring for the truth and caring for accuracy and so on. And then you get the intellectual virtues. And that changes character in the sense that it's not about your values in this, you know, your moral values or anything like that. It's about your ways of thinking, right? And ways of thinking in a way that, which I think should align to the stuff that you actually care about, which is getting things right, being accurate and so forth.
Now, are you attempting to introduce students to this in their first year at Irvine so that this is something that might pervade their whole undergraduate experience, so it's part of the first year experience? Or what's the timing of this? How do you roll it out with students?
Yeah, I mean, you see, even earlier than that, actually, orientation, they start off at orientation. So all students take a sort of online program before they arrive. In fact, we encourage their parents to take it too. So it's kind of interesting. I've been having emails from parents about get quite interested in this Antigua virtues. So we give them a selection of things to give them a flavor for what they're going to encounter. And then as they go through.
Is this optional, or are you requiring students to do this?
Well, I think starting with orientation, I think it's expected. I'm not sure anyone's actually like evaluating them or anything like that. My computer's beeping. So then throughout their degree, they'll take various modules. It's optional in the sense that, you know, we encourage faculty to assign these modules as extra credit. Many faculty are. I guess students could avoid it. It's not required in that sense. They're usually done as extra credit. But we're finding a huge uptake. I mean, even now, and like right now, we have to kind of limit the numbers because we need a control group. But, it, you know, we find like 1,000+ students a year taking it. And we think that will grow to, you know, the next few years, that'll probably double. Eventually the idea is that, you know, most students will take, if not the whole program, at least some of it. So they take certain modules in lower division courses, and then as they move through their degree, they take more advanced modules. And then at the end, we have these capstone modules, which are tied to their major. So it's a chance for students to be thinking about what they've learned about virtuous intellectual character, and they do a project of their design to apply it to a topic in their field. And then that gives them a sense all the way through. So they, you know, by the end, they should have a really clear sense of, you know, what virtuous intellectual character is, how you develop it, and why it's important for their education.
Are you, University of California, Irvine, are you marketing this to prospective students as something that they will, as a reason to consider coming to UCI, that you're doing something like this?
It's on our web pages. It's on, you know, and like I say, it's in orientation, so it's in our materials. It's something that the Chancellor has been very proactive about. So in graduation, pretty much he gives two main addresses a year, graduation and convocation. And he always gives us a plug, which is very nice for the project. So, you know, it's very much at the front, at the forefront of what we're doing. I think, you know, we only started in 2019. It was a pilot then. We've only really grown to the full. It's only now getting to full size, where it reaches across the entire curriculum. you know, this year. So I think it might be a year or two before it's, I think as it grows, it'll grow a bit further. And as it does so, it'll become more explicit. This is what we're doing. But we did the Anteater Virtues quite deliberately, you know, to make it entwined with the mission of the university. So we wanted people to be thinking, well, look, a UCI education isn't just learning what you're going to learn in your subject area. It's also developing you as a virtuous intellect, you know, your virtuous intellectual character. Because this is the, you know, the most useful transferable skill there is, the virtuous intellectual character skills. So, you know, we want to show our students.
You describe that as a transferable skill.
Yeah.
I think that's fascinating.
I mean, it's useful whatever you do. This is the point. Like, whatever you do in life, one thing we say to the students, you know, if you can develop your intellectual character, whatever challenges you face, I mean, obviously you need to learn, you know, if you're doing engineering, things you need to learn, chemistry, things you need to learn. But when, I mean, think about the students today, the challenges they're going to face in the working the marketplace, where they're going to have to probably have to retrain more than once in their careers. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to deal with very challenging technological environments and constant technological change. There's going to be all these challenges they face. And for every stage of these challenges, the things they really need is intellectual character. That's what's going to get them through. I mean, the specific pieces of knowledge they have, they might become superfluous in 10 years' time. But that doesn't mean their education was a loss if the education led to them having virtuous intellectual character, because then it will give them the skills to then pick up whatever else they need to learn and to sum out whatever other obstacles they have, or to listen to the people they need to listen to, and so on.
I see. So in your role as a faculty member, you have a course load you teach. How much time are you spending on this this project? How does this fit into your life as a teacher scholar?
Well, funny thing about this, which is that I started the project and it never occurred to me to ask for any reduction in my workload for doing it. It just never occurred to me. So for many years, I was running it just like in my spare time. And then various people were saying, people were shocked when they found out that I wasn't getting any reduction. So I do finally now have a small reduction in my teaching. I get a one course reduction. In fact, that hasn't even kicked in yet. It kicks in a year or so's time. So, but it does take up an awful lot of my time. But I don't mind, because, you know, for me, it's, you know, I'm fascinated in it. And also as it dovetails with my research interests. So in a sense, although it's kind of, it's not part of my normal teaching responsibilities or anything, it does align with the things that I'm interested in as a researcher. So it doesn't feel like I'm being distracted, you know, from my research by doing this.
Well, tell us a little bit about how it connects to your research.
Yeah, so I'm an epistemologist as a background. That's you know, interest in truth, rationality, knowledge. You know, I have certain views about what knowledge is, what understanding is, what the epistemic goods are, what sort of things as good inquirers we should strive for. And I defend very much a virtues line on this, this broadly Aristotelian line about the importance of the intellectual virtues and moreover their importance to the human flourishing. And so it's very natural then to think, well, how does that play out? You know, if you really believe that, how does that play out in educational context? Because it follows that must be what we're trying to do as educators, right? We must be not just trying to teach people facts and skills. We must be more than that, trying to help them become intellectually virtuous individuals. Mm-hmm. And so that got me thinking about, you know, educational theory and how it plays out here and different practices and their bearing. And primarily, I was thinking of this in terms of schools, in terms of prisons. And then it's latterly trying to think in terms of higher education. I mean, higher education has its own challenges because you're dealing with adults, right? As we said, you know, they're not a captive audience anymore.
We would hope so, yeah.
And you know, related to that, you have to be, you know, there's. I mean, I think this is true in all educational contexts, but especially in higher education, we've got to be very respectful of, you know, a pluralism about people's values and beliefs and so on. So that you have to tread carefully in terms of being clear that what you're teaching people how the good ways to think and not what to think. And I think that's very crucial.
You mentioned that this work that you're doing is in Research One universities, the highest, you know, level of research productivity. Have you thought about trying to do this with, suppose you were to try to do something like this in a community college in California, of which you have, what, about 110, 120 of them? Could you see yourself doing this in a non-elite setting?
So the fact
that you did it in a prison.
Yeah. This is exactly what we're right now we're pairing. So we want to primarily focus on the California system. Mm-hmm. So we thought, for example, it'd be very easy for other UCs to use what we have, right? They have very similar ways of teaching and quarter system and so on. And we also thought, community colleges as well. They could, we made these resources available. They could pick them up and start to integrate them. So one thing we tried to do is try and find at different educational levels, find people to partner with so that we can try this out. And that's what we're doing now. We're in this process. We're partnering with some local schools, with some universities and so on. We want to try and get some community colleges partnered with too, so that we can show at different levels that there are these, not just that we've done it, but that other institutions have taken this and made use of it. And then we're gonna write up these test cases and add them as a sort of part of the resource so that other institutions at that level can see how it was done, not just that we did it here, but how this idea was transplanted into this particular educational context. Because as you say, it should be applicable anywhere.
It should. Yeah, if you could in some way find a way to have as part of your research model how use of this in non-selective institutions could impact academic functioning and what we call persistence and rates of students, this could have enormous potential for the adoption of this. If you could show some kind of impact on the outcomes from higher education that are most widely sought, just fascinating.
This is our hope. I mean, I mentioned this prison project. I mean, the prison project is in a sense the one back in Scotland that I ran. What's really interesting about that is that you can't assume anything about educational background. I mean, this is probably true of prisons in most places, but certainly in Scotland, many of the prisons were illiterate. For example, you couldn't have rules that were written down. So you had to really think about how you're going to, roll out a program like this. And the effect, when you can do it, you can teach for these kind of critical thinking skills. And then you can, demonstrable change, quite radical change, actually, in the prisoners and how they think, how they approach critical thinking tasks, how they start to self-conceive, their self-esteem and things like that in terms of how they respond to educational context. And I think, if you can do that in prisons, I mean, this was a real eye-opener for me. We the effects we got were way beyond what we were expecting. So if you can do that there, where you can't presuppose anything about someone's educational background, then really you can do it anywhere.
Fascinating. Well, that's another advantage of being in a place like UCI. You have other forms of researchers. For instance, you could be looking at the impact of this on self-esteem, as you just said. And we know that self-esteem, in turn, correlates with other attributes of being successful in college and successful in life. So what are your, you've been telling us a lot about some of your plans for expansion. I mean, obviously you really have to sustain this. This is complicated work. You're going to have to stay with this for a long time. And I'm sensing that you feel that Irvine is committed to this. And, they're making these four anteater virtues. This is a high level of visibility for your work.
We've been tremendously lucky. I mean, I think, The alignment, the sort of astral alignment for this has been incredible, because it was so unusual. I think that you've got a group of researchers that are interested in doing this. You've got institutional support at the highest level for doing this, and also that we have, this database system already in place for measuring the outcomes. This is really unusual alignment of the stars. So I think we have to make the most of this opportunity, because I think there's a good reason why this hasn't been done before. It's just there's too many contingencies usually to make it happen. But if we can make it happen here and show that it works, then I think this could really contribute to a conversation, which I think we need to have, about what education is. Mm-hmm. Particularly sort of post-COVID, when a lot of education went online, and a lot of people, I think, thought, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with just simply having online modules and it's all be piecemeal and it's just means to an end in terms of a grade and so on. You know, why not just think of education in those terms? And I think we need to get back to explain to people what education is really about. That that there's more to it than just simply learning facts and skills within a, you know, of a very restricted nature.
Absolutely. I'm assuming that in your thinking as a philosopher, because you're especially interested in the meaning of knowledge and the uses of it, how does this influence your thinking about what I'm interested in this podcast series, is the practice of innovation in higher education? You're doing something that I'm persuaded is very unique, and the potential applications here for improving student learning and improving student outcomes is very very considerable. So what are you learning about what it takes to do and practice successful innovation in a very traditional structured system? I mean, the university, as you know it, I mean, it came from Europe, the American model anyway, and it's 1,000 years old. And so what's a guy from Britain like you learning about innovation in higher education that, as you said earlier, might be a transferable skill?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's encouraging. So there are certain obstacles, and the one has to be aware of. And I think if you want to innovate, you've got to think about how you might overcome them. I mean, one is a kind of defensiveness, which is, I think, natural. I think a lot of educators, I actually think most educators are doing a great job. It's not, one thing we start off by saying, it's not that when we try and change this, bringing the faculty training, it's not that we think people are doing anything wrong. It's rather we think that we can enhance what they're doing by showing how what they're doing fits within this framework. And I think, overcoming the possible defensiveness there, that's a really important feature if you want to innovate at this level. Because, a lot of higher education educators, they're effectively autonomous, particularly in the US system. I mean, I remember someone saying to me, the professor is king, So like in Britain, if you want to change your syllabus or whatever, you have to go through it. There's a committee and everything. You all get scrutinized. But in America, it's just, well, you change your syllabus, it's fine. Just go ahead. There isn't that culture of people getting involved in your teaching. So you have to think about how you're framing it, just try and counteract some of the worries there. And I think there's also, there's naturally, I think there's suspicion about, projects that are trying to change an ethos. People think, they might think you have some sort of political agenda or something like that. And so you have to be very, one has to be, again, tread very carefully. Like I've emphasized a few times, not telling people what to think, trying to teach people.
That's a very important distinction you made. It's more important than ever right now. There are challenges in the United States right now to the kind of freedom you're describing that faculty like you and I are privileged to have. I respect the way you defined that. And certainly listening to you, I would think if some of our listeners are hearing what I'm hearing, they might think, gee, I wish my children could be getting this much younger in the earlier grades. What a difference this might make in terms of producing the kind of teenagers we have in this country.
Well, if I could, I'd like to give a plug. There are two fantastic schools in the Long Beach area, which were founded on the principle of they're called the Intellectual Virtues. They're the same name. Intellectual Virtues Academy is a middle school and a high school, founded by a colleague of mine, Jason Baer, and some friends of his. He's at LMU, and he works on this project with us too. These schools are incredible. What they do, the whole curriculum is they're doing what we're doing at university level. They're doing it at school level.
And where did you say this was?
It's in Long Beach.
Long Beach, California.
Yeah, Long Beach. And I'd encourage people to look them up. They have lots of resources on their webpage. It's incredible. I would have loved to have gone to a school like that. I'd love for my kids to have gone to a school like that. And when you see it in action, you think, why can't all schools be like this? Trying to help right from the off students to think in terms of developing their intellectual characters and just instill it at every stage. So, what it is to learn is always framed into developing themselves intellectually, and the huge impact on the educational outcomes there, including sort of social outcomes as well. Like you mentioned, self-esteem, respect for others, and things like that. These are really important social values we want to instill in students, and I think when we transform that, I mean, I'm focusing on higher education, but it seems to me we need to do this with education in general, get people to see what its tremendous value could be.
Well, I suspect some people that are listening to this are going to want to follow up with you. And so how about as we close here, would you tell us how people can find you?
Well, I'm quite lucky in that Duncan Pritchard's, you know, in the Google age, it's a fairly unusual name. So you can put my name in and then it comes up. It's a great thing, isn't it? You know, like who'd want to be, you know, Bill Smith in an age like this? You know, no one can find you.
So they just go to Dr. Google and they enter Duncan Pritchard.
Yeah, or Duncan Pritchard UCI definitely would do it.
Okay, definitely UCI, yeah.
And okay. That will find me. And then from there, you can get links. So the Anteater Virtues, we have, you know, there's a web page for that. I can't recall the address offhand, but we could send it to your listeners. And we have, and also we don't have all the resources up publicly yet, but a selection of the resources are already up publicly. So anyone wants to try that selection, they can. They click the link, and then they can do a selection of modules, actually.
Well, I'm making a mental note that I need to do a follow-up interview with you in a year or two and see where you've moved this. And this is definitely a work in development.
Because, you know, a year or two from now, we'll have the first results of the longitudinal study. And so we could talk about that. And hopefully by then as well, we would have some of the partner projects, you know, in other institutions will start to have come to fruition. You know, they'll have been doing activities and so forth. So we'll get some sense of how this is starting to spread beyond UCI. So I'd love to.
Well, let's you and I have a separate brainstorming conversation sometime. Maybe there's some ways that the Gardner Institute can help you. Okay.
I'd love that.
I'm not who are we to help you? You're doing fine on your own, but you know, we academic people, we need to be doing things collegially, and we are, obviously. I want to thank you for sharing this, and I hope other colleges and university will be thinking if they could identify some virtues connected to character that were apolitical and, you know, a modest number of them, what would they call these? How would they use them? What would they be trying to develop in people? And so thank you for providing us this stimulation to engage in this kind of thinking. And as you said, action. This is not just an intellectual exercise. This is very applied.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And thank you for, because one thing we're trying to do is amplify this. We want to get this message out. So, you know, these kind of interviews are really, particularly with an audience like yours of people who are already interested in pedagogical innovation.
Yes, they are. Important. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Professor Pritchard, it has been a privilege. And you will hear from me again, and I suspect you're going to hear from some people who heard you today.
Okay. I'd like that very much.
So thanks for best me. Wishes to you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you for joining us for Office Hours with John Gardner. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Gardner Institute, and we wish to thank our guests and the entire team who make this podcast possible.